genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brains.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, everybody. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every weekday, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ AM 1400, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, well, then you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is NPR done right. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. That's 639-0008. If you're outside of the county, it's area code 805-639-0008. You'll want to keep that number handy because we have ice cream to give away, one ice cream coupon in each half hour of the show today. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is how our perception gets manipulated. We have two guests who are going to talk about how both politics and the news have impacted forces that we've never considered up until now. Our first guest is a medical doctor who's practiced psychiatry with patients ranging from law partners to the criminally insane, which makes him uniquely qualified to talk about the psyche of politicians. We're going to talk about what goes on in the minds of politicians. Our second guest is a journalist and a news media provocateur. We'll be discussing how anyone with a computer can influence the media by initiating a small ripple of a story that eventually turns into a tsunami. And as always, you can call us at 639-0008 if you want to join in the conversation. Dr. Melvin Lurie has practiced psychiatry for over 30 years. His patients, as I said, have ranged from senior executives and law partners to the criminally insane and psychotic homeless as well. He's taught medical students at Harvard University and Tufts University, two very fine schools back east. Dr. Lurie is an honors graduate of Harvard Medical School himself, where he won the Resnick Research Prize for the work that he did at the Pasteur Institute in France, which leads me to believe he probably speaks French as well. He's been involved in local politics for over 15 years, running for elective office, also serving on boards and speaking at legislative town meetings. His latest book is titled Psyche Politics, How to Read the Political Mind, a Book for Voters. Welcome to the show, Melvin. How are you today?
Be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you as our guest today. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, now you've got this new term that you have coined. It's called psyche politics. So in a way, after reading the book, it describes what happens when we carry certain of our childhood lessons with us into adulthood and then how that affects our politics. How do you describe psyche politics?
Well, I think that's a good way right there. That's a big part of it. It's the application of human psychology to politics. And so the book traces us, our path from the genes, that is what we're born with, primarily all of our survival instinct and all of our instinct to reproduce in kind, and how this is all developed in the family, and then, boom, we're out in the world, especially the political world. I also talk about image creation, perception and misperception, things like that. The idea is really for people to see more of the dots and connect more of the political dots.
All righty. So a lot of this depends on how we were raised and the attitudes in the family. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that and how that carries over with us into our adult life and into our political views?
Yes. Well, there's certainly variations on the themes, but let's talk about the themes first. One of the primary things we do when we're little, and when I say little, I mean 1.5 to 2.5 years old,
mm-hmm.
Is that, number one, we are driven by pleasure in those years to get food or to walk, because we're starting to walk at that age. And if you can't remember how pleasurable it is for little kids to walk, just take a look at those little toddlers at the next family affair. In any case, what soon happens is that the pleasure we get is tempered by the reality that we cannot do everything. So if we're just learning to walk, we can't just walk off the porch. or down the stairs. Reality tells us we have to put a limit on our pleasure. This is something that is going on in today's world, but before we get to today's world, I'll talk about something else that's pretty powerful in the family, and that's our identifications, especially our identifications with our parents. Now, we're talking about the early years, the years we can't even remember. So these things are embedded in our minds, and yet we are unaware of their full context. Nonetheless, there is a tendency we have, and most people can recognize it in themselves, to identify with their parents, sometimes for the better, some of their assets, and sometimes even for some of the things they don't do so well.
Mm.
This pattern also is carried into adult life, and I can talk about how it might affect our political decisions if you like.
Well, we do. We want to come to that and see how that impacts us. But before we do, I want to ask you the bigger question is, why did you decide to write Psyche Politics now of all times?
Well, that's a good question, and I ask myself that. I mean, these are ideas and concepts that I've put together over the course of really a generation of being a practicing psychiatrist. But here's why now. It started with the Obama-McCain election. Obama was promising fundamental change. Fundamental change is scary. There's often unrest with fundamental change, and it doesn't matter if that fundamental change is for the better or for the worse. It's change. It disrupts a lot of people's lives, and so there's a possibility for unrest there. In fact, I have to tell you, Bill, I haven't felt like this since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Wow.
There was a big chance for fundamental change.
Yeah, if not out-and-out death. So, yeah, okay. So you equate the modern times, the current times that we're living in, or at least you did at that time, you equated it to the Cuban Missile Crisis, rather
severe.
Well, it
gave me the same feeling. It did give me the same feeling.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So that's what prompted you to write this book. But help me to connect the dots. Eric, say you've got this feeling. You know that change is going to be happening because that's what President Obama was promising back in his campaigns. And you knew that change was going to happen. But then why did you decide to write about the psyche of politics at that time? What is it going to help the reader to understand by reading your book?
It'll help the reader understand, for example, the unconscious allure of communism, even though communism fails every place it goes. There's still an allure for it, and that has to do with socialism and Marxism, too, all those wrapped up into one. That's something, I think that's a trap that we fall into. The other trap that we fall into is we don't temper the pleasure we get from helping or giving, especially to the least fortunate. And if that's not tempered, then we wind up taking too much away from those that are somewhat fortunate, and those people become the Tea Party.
Well, all right. Let's equate this. We're talking, everybody, to Dr. Melvin Lurie, and this book is The Psyche of Politics, How to Read the Political Mind. It's a book for voters. So let's get down to it. Let's talk about how your book equates to some of the different labels that are out there. And let's start with some of the more common ones, Republicans. And how does your book, Psyche Politics, how does that relate to republicanism?
Okay, well, for one, the Republicans have been faced with two conundrums, two puzzles. One is, how do you attract people to government when the very nature of the party is to limit government? Why would someone who's competent and believes in the Republican philosophy want to get involved in politics in the first place? So the Republicans are faced with this conundrum, that is, a lot of talented people stay in the private sector and don't get involved in government in the first place.
Mm. Now, what is it in our psyche that makes us want to become Republicans and then once a Republican want to run for office?
Well, the second question is more easily answered, because this is what happens with the Republican Party, is that it tends to draw people in to be active and to be involved in government when they get angry, and that's what's happened nowadays. The Tea Party movement, for example, is not purely Republican. It's Republican and it's Democrat. It's for people who value their autonomy, their independence, and don't like it when what they've worked for is given to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the middle children when the mother or the father pays too much attention to the baby. So the Tea Party is an example of a movement that if the Republicans wanted. They're in a better position to incorporate that entire movement into their party, which would be they'd have a lot of energized Republicans. They'd also pull in a lot of Democrats.
All right. So very much like during the Ronald Reagan years when there was more of pluralism and there was out there. But let me go back to that for just a second. So you say that the Republicans could embrace the Tea Party members more easily, and I agree with that. But what will that do with some of the other constituencies within the Republican Party, and or how do you explain the religious right and the religious fundamentalism within the Republican Party?
Well, for some reason, the religious right has gravitated to the Republican Party in the same way that some ethnic and racial groups have gravitated to the Democratic Party. It might be because the Republicans courted them. It's unclear. The Republicans also tend to be traditionalists. That's where this word conservative comes from. And people who are very religious also tend to be conservative. So there, in that sense, there's a match. But it actually, as you know, it's a problem when a huge percentage of any constituency is involved in only one party. In many ways, they lose their power because that party takes them for granted and doesn't have to court them as much. Well, that's just a little conundrum that happens sometimes.
That is true. We're talking to Dr. Melvin Laurie, everybody. And let me ask you, we're going to have to go to a break here in just a minute, Melvin. But before we do, let me ask you, have we outgrown the two-party system? I mean, if you look at Europe, you have multiple parties. You've got the Green, you've got the Conservatives, you've got the Liberals, you've got the tree huggers. You've got it all over there. Have we outgrown the two-party system here in the United States?
I sure hope not, because one of the elements of European society that's led to instability has been multiple parties. This was true in Italy for years. I believe it was true in Spain. There's a danger with because you have to have coalitions formed, and there's even more wheeling and dealing, even just within the legislature, let alone the states or the provinces, if it's another country. I hope we haven't outgrown the two-party system. But what is happening is that less people feel that they have to belong to a party. There are various reasons for this. This is why you have a lot of people who retain their independence. They don't have to acknowledge their allegiance to any one party. They can shift back and forth, that kind of thing.
All right. We're talking to Dr. Melvin Laurie, everybody. We're going to have to take a break right now, Melvin. But before we do, I want you to think about this while we're on break. We've just discussed Republicans. We've discussed the Tea Party movement. When we come back, I want to talk about the Democrats. And I also want to talk about communism, popularism, and the victim cult. So think about those while we're on break. And we'll be back after this short break.
And now, back to Brainstorming with Billy.
The Living Brain.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bill Frank. You're listening to Brainstorming with Billy Brain here on KKZZ AM 1400, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is how our perception is manipulated. My first guest is Dr. Melvin Laurie. We've been talking about psyche politics, how political mind is formed, particularly at a young age. And we had just concluded talking about Republicans and the Tea Party movement. We're going to come back and talk about Democrats. But before we do that, I want to give away some ice cream. I told you to keep the telephone number handy. I'm going to give away McConnell's ice cream coupon for a free ice cream cone or a free cup of ice cream from McConnell's right there on East Main Street in Ventura. I'll give that away to the third caller at 639-0008, 639-0008. Call in and the coupon is yours. Now, Melvin, back to you. We were talking before the break about Republicans. We were talking about the Tea Party movement, and we concluded by saying that you didn't want to see us get away from a two-party system, that the multi-party systems that you see in Europe and other countries is damaging to them. So let's return to one of our traditional parties here, and that is the Democratic Party. What is the mindset and the psyche behind the Democratic Party?
Well, the Democratic Party of today is an outgrowth of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt coalition. Basically, back then, Roosevelt pulled together the people who were disenfranchised then, and was considered to be the president of the little guy. That would attract little guys. That would attract people who didn't feel really a part of the system. And he built a strong coalition at that point. Now, that's the political end. What's happened today, of course, is that some people are attracted to this mode of gathering voters. And the question is not so much why the active Democratic politicians focus on the disenfranchised, the victims, the helpless, and want to give them more. The question that's really, I think, a head-scratcher is why it attracts people who aren't necessarily interested in politics per se, they're not interested in becoming active in politics, so they're not interested in buying votes, but they follow this path of supporting the underprivileged, supporting the victim. Now here's, so you have people like Warren Buffett, for example, who was a strong supporter of President Obama.
Yes.
And people wonder, how can someone whose entire life was spent using the free enterprise system, notice I didn't say capitalist system, we can get into that if you like, but I said the free enterprise system, why would he support someone who appeared not to support the free enterprise system so much? Here's why Buffett and others do. When we're little, remember, I talked about being like parents.
Right.
Remember?
Right.
Or identifying with their parents. But another thing that happens is when people get to the point where they're so far, they're so
disenfranchised,
successful, they're like parents. They're like the parents we had when we were little. Remember, our parents needed nothing from us. Our parents had it together. This is from the point of view of a two-year-old. Our parents had it together. And so these people become like parents. Leaders become like parents. But let's not talk about leaders so much, but rather people who are very successful who are drawn to the democratic ideals. What happens is they start acting like parents. And what do parents do?
They
focus their attention on the weakest. And how do the people in the middle feel? Left out, ignored, taken from. This is the pattern that's driving the victim cult. This is the pattern that's driving the Republican, the Democratic Party right now. And, you know, these things shift over the years, but this is how I see it right now.
All right. We're talking to Dr. Melvin Laurie, everybody, his book, The Psyche of Politics. Well, Melvin, based on what you've just said about the Democrats and how the rich become parental figures, if you will, taken to an extreme, doesn't this lead directly into communism or at least socialism?
Very much so. I mean, because, listen, this is the unconscious allure that communism has, again, despite its failures. What do we see when we are 2 and 3 and 4 years old in the family? We see those who have the ability, and who are they? Our parents, giving to those who need. Who are those? The babies.
Mm-hmm.
And so because we identify with parents, we find this quite natural. The only problem is it fits in the family and it doesn't fit in society in general. But this is the reason for the allure, that unconsciously we're drawn to be like our parents, and our parents have modeled this very kind of behavior. They're the ones with the ability, so we become like them. And they, what do? They give to the less fortunate, so will we.
That's the allure. All right. Now, I want to ask you about one more category, and then I'm going to challenge you a little bit on your definitions as you've laid them out here. But the category, you know, you're talking to Ventura County, California. This is Reagan country. We're the home of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library out here. So this naturally leads me to think about the popularism that President Reagan had in his 2 terms in office. How do you describe or how do you rationalize, based on your book, Psyche Politics, popularism?
Okay, well, Reagan was certainly very unusual in being able to do this. Here's what I'm going to use the word populism as opposed to popularism, and a successful populist will become quite popular. But populism itself is actually, as I see it, a critical term toward the masses. It's a demeaning term to the masses. What it kind of implies is the masses cannot apply reality. The masses cannot have control of their emotions. And so if a politician comes along and touches their emotions, they'll vote for that politician. They won't step back and say, wait a second, it might feel good to do X, Y, or Z, but what's the reality here? Forget the pleasure. We're going to follow our reality. Well, with Reagan came in, and he said something that everybody was feeling, which is, we want to get those commies. We want to stop this Cold War. We want to be safe in this world because, remember, the communists were threatening to take us over. There was a lot of disbelief, but certainly because he said that, he drew people to him. Now, a lot of populists don't do any more than that. When they get into office, they can't do any more because the emotions that have been suppressed were suppressed for a reason, because there's no way to deal with them. But what Reagan was able to do was to go after the Soviet Union, and he went around the flank, and he went underneath, and he went in various directions to weaken them. And finally, although the ultimate collapse was under his successor, George Bush Sr., really Reagan laid the groundwork for that. So he was both populist and he delivered. He was very believable. And one of the emotions that he drew on was aggression. These are the Reagan Democrats. They might think I'm a Democrat, my parents have been Democrats, I'm in the unions, I'm a Democrat, but God darn, I want to get those commies. And it really felt good. These are the people I feel that Reagan drew out and became his, you know, the difference in these campaigns of his.
Very interesting. We're talking to Dr. Melvin Laurie, everybody, about his book, Psyche Politics. Now, after you've laid it all out for the various political parties, let me challenge you a little bit, because the lines are blurring between Republican and Democrat, between liberal and conservative. Let me just give you an example. Let's talk about free trade. Let's talk about our manufacturing moving overseas to other countries there. A union member who typically would identify with the Democratic Party may, in fact, side with a Republican over the issue of sending jobs offshore, because the Republican wants a strong manufacturing base here in the United States, doesn't want to see those jobs going overseas. So now you've got two very radically different political parties yet agreeing on a particular issue. How does that play out in your book, Psyche Politics?
You know, I don't get into that much, because that's the kind of psychology that I think is on the surface. It's been expressed by the term politics makes strange bedfellows.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the ebbs and flows of the makeup of the parties, because, you know, you're absolutely right. When different issues come along, it can draw people together that previously were not together. And this will continue to happen. But this, I see this as a more conscious level, and I was trying to add the dots that are unconscious.
Okay. All right. I can go with that, and I understand what it is you're saying. What else can psyche politics explain that we see going on in the political world besides just our party differences that we have?
Well, it can help us see what this quality of presidential is. The quality of presidential is often very vague, and the talking heads, these are the reporters on the air, will make speculation. So-and-so did this, that's presidential. So-and-so did that, that's not presidential. What's the common denominator? Still, it's unconscious. No one puts their finger on it. The common denominator is that for someone to be presidential, they cannot act unparental. And here's what I mean. The parent, again, from the perspective of the toddler, has it all together, is not embarrassed. George Bush never lost his embarrassed smile. At the end of a lot of things he would say, out would come a smile. And it was often an embarrassed smile. Bill Clinton lost his, and Barack Obama lost his. They're able to say things and finish up with a serious tone, like they are the parent. Here's another thing. Here's a trap that Sarah Palin has fallen in, and it's one reason why her detractors have gained traction. There's a quality of Sarah Palin that is unparental from the point of view of the little kids within us. And you know what that is?
What's that?
Sexuality. Think for a minute. Can you think about your parents and sex?
I try not to.
Yeah, that's a very uncomfortable mix right there. Most people have the hardest time doing it, and basically we don't do it. All of a sudden, Sarah Palin comes along. Now look, she is a media person. She's, even though she has an older family, she looks young, she acts young, and she's quite active. A man can get away with that, but a woman who looks too sexual will make people uncomfortable with her. Now remember, let's take another a successful woman female politician, Margaret Thatcher.
All right.
Margaret Thatcher was your in-charge mom. You knew if you grew up in Margaret Thatcher's house, you sat up straight, you finished what was on your plate, you did your homework. There was no ifs, ands, and buts. This is the persona that Margaret Thatcher gave off.
All right. Let me ask you one real quick question, then we're going to have to let you go. Leave it at that, Melvin. But we're going into a very heated gubernatorial race here in California, Meg Whitman versus Jerry Brown. So on this scale that you're talking about, sexuality versus motherhood, parentalness, where does Meg Whitman fall on that scale?
I don't know the situation out there well enough, but I've seen a few pictures of her, and I don't think she gives the Sarah Palin persona.
All right, so she's not Sarah Palin. She might not be Margaret Thatcher either, but we'll see how that plays out in our gubernatorial election. Dr. Laurie, one last thing. If people want to get a hold of your book, which is Psyche Politics, where would you direct them to go?
You know, I think the best place now is on Amazon.com. It's coming into the bookstores, but it's not there yet, and it's hard to predict. But it's on Amazon.com, and if you just put in my name or Psyche Politics, P-S-Y-C-H-E Politics, it should come up. The cover is red, white, and blue.
Very patriotic. And Melvin, thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay, it's my pleasure.